Well, our theme this evening is the Covenanters in Ireland. The Covenanters in Ireland. I'm not pretending to be a historian, but it is useful for us to have some idea of Irish Covenanter history. The background, as you will know, no doubt, was that the early origins of Christianity in Ireland were uncertain. There was Patrick and the Celtic Church, and the corrupting influence of Rome before actual Roman Catholicism prevailed. So-called Saint Patrick, of course we don't believe that particular people are, that's a particular title, saints or true Christians are all saints, but so-called Saint Patrick was not Roman Catholic in his views by any manner of means, but Pope Adrian IV, by mid-12th century, assumed control of Ireland and gave Ireland to Henry II of England in 1155. It's not something that everyone is aware of, but it was the Pope who actually gave Ireland to English control. Henry VIII, of course, broke away from the papacy, but the English bishops were supposed to usher in Reformation in Ireland, but to put it bluntly, they bungled it. There was no Irish Bible till 1602. The ministers lacked zeal to propagate the truth. There was a Jesuit counter-reformation in 1561, and this rendered Protestantism in Ireland very weak. Then we have the plantation of Ulster. The rebellion of the Ulster chieftains ending in 1608, with the surviving chieftains having fled and their lands being declared forfeit. James I decided to plant Scots and English settlers, and among these, godliness was at a very low ebb. Sometimes the picture is given that the planters were examples of godliness. By and large, they weren't. They were largely ungodly. Several godly Scots ministers came in the wake of the plantation, and some conformed to the Church of Ireland, but others did not. Notably, Robert Blair, who was settled in Bangor in 1623, Josias Welsh of Temple Patrick, the son of John Welsh of Ayr, the grandson of John Knox, Temple Patrick, he was known as the Cock of the Conscience because of his awakening preaching. John Livingston in Killinchy, this is John Livingston who preached at Kirkashots on that memorable occasion, Kirkashots in Scotland, from Ezekiel 36, 25 to 26. Behold, I sprinkle clean water upon you, a sermon after the communion, on the Monday of the communion at Kirkashots, when it's reckoned that about 500 people were converted at once. Well, John Livingston was settled in Killinchy, up near Newtownards, in that, or Comber, that direction. And he has left a diary, and it's quite amazing to read something of the diary of John Livingston of Killinchy. He tells us this: in the summer 1630, being in Irwin, Mr. Robert Cunningham, minister at Holywood in Ireland, and some while before that Mr. John Dunbar, minister at Lairn in Ireland, proposed to me, seeing there was no appearances I could enter into the ministry in Scotland, whether or not I would be content to go to Ireland. I answered them both that if I got a clear call and free entry, I would not refuse. About August 1630, I got letters from the Viscount Clandeboyes to come to Ireland in reference to a call to the parish of Killinchy, whither I went and got an unanimous call from the parish, and because it was needful that I should be ordained to the ministry, and the Bishop of Down, in whose bounds Killinchy was a corrupt, timorous man, and would require some engagement before my Lord Clandyboy sent some with me, and wrote to me Andrew Knox, wrote to Mr. Andrew Knox, Bishop of Raphoe, who, when I came and gave him the letter from my Lord Clandyboy and from the Earl of Wigton and some others that I had for that purpose brought out of Scotland, he told me that he knew my errand, that I came to him because I had scruple against episcopacy and ceremonies, according as Mr. Josias Welsh and some others had done before, and he thought his old age was prolonged for little of purpose but to do such offices, that if I scrupled to call him my lord, he cared not much for it. All he would desire of me, because they got there but few sermons, that I would preach there at Ramelun the next Sabbath, and he would send for Mr. William Cunningham and some two or three other neighbouring ministers to be present, who after sermon should give me imposition of hands. But although they performed the work, he behoved to be present, for otherwise he durst not answer to the state. He gave me the book of ordination, and desired that anything I scrupled at, I should draw a line over in the margin, and Mr. William Cunningham should not read it. But I found it had been so marked by some others off before that I needed not mark anything, so the Lord was pleased to carry business far beyond anything that I had thought or almost ever desired. It's not perhaps all that easy to follow. It's written, it's partly shortened phrases and also older English. But he's saying there that he was ordained by a presbytery, albeit the bishop was present among them, and that the questions for ordination, others before him had already scored out what consistent Presbyterians couldn't accept. Then he says, that winter following, I was in great heaviness, for although the people were very tractable, yet they were generally very ignorant, and I saw no appearance of doing any good among them. Yet in a short time the Lord was pleased that some of them began to understand their condition. The Bishop of Down had an evil eye upon me because I had gone elsewhere to receive ordination, and at a visitation at Down in the spring, following whither I went much against my will, but Mr. Blair and Mr. Cunningham drew me, saying my staying away would occasion more trouble. The bishop, before all the ministers, inquired of me what was my opinion of the service book. My answer so dissatisfied him that there was some appearance I might be censured shortly, but my Lord Clandyboy prevailed with him that I should be forborne. The parish of Killinchy, being looked on but as a pendicle of another parish, to wit Killyleagh, there was never any official court kept in it. All the while I was there, not only had we the public worship free of any inventions of men, but we had also a tolerable discipline, for after I had been some while amongst them, by the advice of all the heads of families, their ablest for that charge were chosen elders to oversee the manners of the rest, and some deacons to gather and distribute the collections we met every week, and such as fell in notorious public scandals we desired to come before us. Such as came were dealt with both in public and private, and prevailed with to confess their scandal before the congregation at the Saturday sermon before the communion, which was twice in the year, and then were admitted to the communion, such as after dealing either would not come before it, or through contempt would not be convinced to acknowledge their fault before the congregation upon the Saturday before the communion, their names of scandal and impenitency was read out before the congregation, and they debarred from the communion, which proved such a terror that we found very few of that sort. He goes on. I'm sorry to give you such a long extract, but it gives you some idea of the work of the Lord. not too far from here at that time. We needed not have the communion after, for there were some 9 or 10 parishes within the bounds of some 20 miles or little more there, wherein there were godly and able ministers that kept a society together, and every one of these had the communion twice in the year, and that at different times, and had 2 or 3 of the neighbouring ministers to help them at. And most part of the religious people of every parish used to report to the communions of the rest of the parishes. The ministers were Mr. Robert Blair, minister at Bangor, Mr. Robert Cunningham, minister at Hollywood, Mr. James Hamilton at Belterwater, Mr. John Ridge at Antrim, Mr. Henry Colwart at Oldstone, Mr. George Dunbar at Lairn, I presume that's Larne, Mr. Josias Welch at Temple Patrick, and Mr. Andrew Stewart at Donegal. Most of all these used ordinarily to meet the first Friday of every month at Antrim, where was a great and good congregation, and that day was spent, this is once a month, that day was spent in fasting and prayer and public preaching, commonly 2 preached before noon and 2 after noon. We used to come together on the Thursday night before and stayed the Friday night after, and consulted about such things as concerned the carrying on of the work of God, and these meetings among ourselves were sometimes as profitable as either presbyteries or synods. Out of these parishes formerly mentioned, and out of some others also, such as laid religion to heart, used to convene to these meetings, especially out of the 6 mile water, which was nearest land, and which there was greatest number of religious people, and frequently the Sabbath after the Friday's meeting, the communion was celebrated in one or other of these parishes. So there were these meetings once a month in Antrim, and the people gathered in large numbers, and the whole day was spent in preaching, prayer, and psalmody. And then he says this: among all these ministers there was never any jar or jealousy, yea, nor among the professors, that's the professors of the faith, the greatest part of them being Scots, and some good number of gracious English, all whose contention was to prefer others to themselves. And although the gifts of the ministers was much different, yet it was not observed that the heavens followed any to the undervaluing of others. Many of those religious professors had been both ignorant and profane, and for debt and want and worse causes had left Scotland. Yet the Lord was pleased by his word to work such a change. I do not think there were more lively and experienced Christians anywhere, nor were these at that time in Ireland, and that in good numbers, and several of them persons of a good outward condition in the world, being but lately brought in, the lively edge was not yet gone off them, and the perpetual fear that the bishops would put away their ministers made them with great hunger wait on the ordinances. I have known them that have come several miles from their own houses to communions, to the Saturday sermon, and spent the whole Saturday night in several companies, sometimes a minister being with them, sometimes themselves alone in conference and prayer, and waited on the public ordinances the whole Sabbath, and spent the Sabbath night likewise, and yet at the Monday sermon not troubled with sleepiness, and so have not slept till they went home. Because of their holy and righteous carriage, they were generally reverenced, even by the graceless multitude that they lived among. Some of them had attained such a dexterity of expressing religious purposes by the resemblance of worldly things, that being at feasts or meals in common inns where were ignorant, profane persons, they would among themselves entertain a spiritual discourse for a long time, and they other professed that although they spake good English, They could not understand what they said. In those days, it was no great difficulty for a minister to preach or pray in public or private. Such was the hunger of the hearers, and it was hard to judge whether there was more of the Lord's presence in the public or in the private meetings. So that gives you some idea of the work of the Spirit of God that was taking place through the preaching of men like Livingstone and Welsh at that time. And amazingly, God initially used to a considerable extent to awaken the people to a sense of sin a man called James Glendinning. Glendinning was eccentric, to say the least. Some would say he was bordering on mental imbalance, and he seemed to be able to preach nothing much but God's wrath upon abounding wickedness among the people. And yet God used this man to awaken the people to a sense of sin, and then other more judicious ministers entered the work, men like Livingstone, and the Lord used the preaching of the gospel to effect a great transformation among the planters, who had largely been so ungodly when they came from Scotland. And in 1641, a Scottish army arrived to deal with a rebellion, and this led to the formal organization of a presbytery in 1642. Well, that was what was going on in the north of Ireland. Meanwhile, in Scotland, the work of reformation under Knox had been constantly attacked between 1567 and 1637. The Second Reformation, from 1637 to 1651, was a God-given resurgence of biblical and reformed truth. And in 1638, the National Covenant of Scotland was signed by vast multitudes in Scotland. And it pledged the people to uphold the reformed faith and worship and Christ's kingship over church and state. They held that Christ is king over all and to be acknowledged as such, and that the individual and the church is to acknowledge Christ's kingship, and also the state, not only the ruler in his personal life, but in the use of his public office, he is to acknowledge Christ's kingship over him. So church and state are to be separate and distinct, but the church has a duty to teach the state its biblical responsibility, and the state, the ruler, has a duty under Christ to uphold the law of God in the land, and in so doing to facilitate the true religion and the function of the church. So that was going on in Scotland, the National Covenant. Meanwhile, in England, the Westminster Assembly was called by Parliament on the 1st of July 1643, initially to simply revise the 39 Articles of the Church of England. But as the Civil War progressed, the parliamentarian forces were struggling and wanted help from Scotland. The Scots were agreeable if the English sought uniformity of the three kingdoms in doctrine, worship, and discipline. The famous words of Bailey, that the English were for a civil league, we for a religious covenant. That is, the Scots said, yes, we'll help, but we want a covenant binding the kingdoms to seek uniformity in doctrine, worship, and discipline in the churches. This resulted in the Solemn League and Covenant committing the three kingdoms of England, Scotland, and Ireland to seek uniformity in the reformed faith and acknowledging Christ as king over the nation and over the church also. And the remit of the assembly was increased to include not only revising the Articles of the Church of England, but producing a confession of faith, catechism, directory of worship, and form of church government, so that the civil war in God's providence was the means of the Westminster Assembly having a much bigger job to do, given a much bigger job, and with the result that we have the Confession of Faith, two catechisms, directory for worship, and the form of Presbyterial Church government. And the Solemn League and Covenant was signed by large numbers in Ireland. This is something that isn't that well known. And I want to give you some idea of the place of the Solemn League and Covenant in Ireland. And for this, we rely largely on a book, A True Narrative of the Rise and Progress of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland, by Patrick Adair. And he tells us this: in March 1644, the Scotch army, through discouragement and want of maintenance, proposing to return to Scotland, were taking an oath which the presbytery judged ambiguous, scandalous, contrary to the covenant, and a divisive motion. They sent two of their number to the meeting of officers at Carrickfergus to declare the same to them, and withal they wrote to the commission of the Church of Scotland concerning the present state of the army and that oath, with their declaration against it. After this came over by the assembly appointment, that's from Scotland, Masters James Hamilton, William Adair, John Weir, and Hugh Henderson, very soon one after another. They were all present at the presbytery, held on Monday the 1st of April 1644, showing their commissions and bringing a letter from the commission of the General Assembly directing the ministers of the Scotch army to administer the Solemn League and Covenant to the army, which was accordingly done. The ministers who had charge of regiments as their congregations did administer it to the regiments, and the regiments who had no ministers received it from the ministers who had come from Scotland, and all entered into that oath with great appearance of desire and affection, some really, and others went along. I have heard that none refused it but Major Dalzell in the Major General Regiment, who then and all his days thereafter proved an atheist and an open enemy to the work of God. But though the army ministers had no commissions except for the army, yet in those places where the covenant was administered to the army, the whole country about came and willingly joined themselves in the covenant. A very few excepted, who were either some old conformist ministers or known profane and ungodly persons, so that there were more of the country became swearers than were men in the army. Yet, because the Black Oath had been generally pressed and taken by many in the country a few years before, those who had taken the Black Oath were not admitted to the covenant until they had first publicly declared their repentance of it. So those who had taken the Black Oath, which was contrary to the interests of the Reformed faith, they had to publicly acknowledge the wrongness of it before they were allowed to take the Solemn League and Covenant. It was reported by the worthy Mr. Weir, who administered the covenant at Carrickfergus, where least was expected, that there were 400 who had renounced the Black Oath publicly and taken the covenant, and 1,400 of the army and of towns and places about, besides women, who had not taken the same and now entered into the covenant. And there were in other places large equal proportions and more people running into it where it was administered, as in Belfast, Cumber, Newtown, Bangor, also in Broad Island, Island Magee, and other places in the county of Antrim, not only where soldiers were quartered, but where they were not quartered, The ministers from Scotland, on their own invitation, did visit them and administered the covenant unto them. The covenant was taken in all places with great affection, partly with sorrow for former judgments and sins and miseries, partly with joy under present consolation in the hopes of laying a foundation for the work of God in the land and overthrowing popery and prelacy, which had been the bane and ruin of the poor church. Sighs and tears were joined together, and it is much to be observed both the way ministers used toward the people for clearing their consciences in order to the covenant, in explaining it before they proposed it to the people, and from scripture and solid consequences from it, clearing every article from it, and thereafter offered it only to those whose consciences stirred them up to it. Indeed, they were assisted with more than the ordinary presence of God in that work in every place they went to, so that all the hearers did bear them witness that God was with them. And the sensible presence and appearance of God with them in these exercises did overcome many of those who otherwise were not inclined that way, so that very few were found to resist the call of God. The solemnity and spirituality of carrying on this work was like the cloud filling the temple, there being a new tabernacle erecting in the land. And those who had not seen those things before, nor were well acquainted with them, said, as the people in Christ's time, we have seen strange things today. Yea, even the malignants, who were against the covenant, durst not appear on the contrary, for the people generally held their ministers as servants of God, and coming with a blessed message and errand to them. So the covenant, the solemn league and covenant, was sworn by multitudes of people freely and without coercion and sincerely and knowledgeably. And it is undoubtedly true that there was less pressure to sign it in Ireland than anywhere else. Adair then goes on, he describes the difficulties in Belfast, and yet there were still those who signed the covenant in Belfast, and the great opponents of the covenant, how their numbers gradually dwindled and their families became insignificant, and others coming into Belfast signed the covenant. But then he goes on, thus the ministers, having gone about that work in all places in Down and several places in Antrim, where the Scotch army were quartered, they resolved to go to Coleraine and the route also for that purpose, and according as they had clearness to go further toward Derry, now Londonderry, but Derry in those days. Mr. Adair and Mr. Weir visited first Antrim, and after that Ballymena, then a small garrison. In both places God was signally present with the ministers and people, the Lord assisting the ministers in the work of preaching and explaining the covenant, and the people with much affection to receive it. The ministers were directed to insist on sweet and suitable subjects thereon, as Ezra chapter 8 verse 23, where that text says, so we fasted and sought our God for this, and he was entreated of us. And Psalm 102 verse 13, thou shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion, for her time for favour, yea, the set time is come. And from Ballymena they went with a guard of horse toward Coleraine under one William Hume of General Leslie's regiment. They went the next day, being Thursday, to the church, and few being present except the soldiers of the garrison, they explained the covenant to them and left it to their serious thoughts till the next Sabbath. On this Lord's Day the convention was very great from town and country. They expounded more fully the covenant, and among other things told the people that their miseries had come from those sorts of people who were there, that is in the covenant, sworn against, and especially from the papists. The righteous hand of God had afflicted them for going so near the papists in their former worship and government in the church. And whereas the Episcopal party endeavoured peaceableness with the papists by symbolising with them in much of their superstition, the sovereign holy Lord had turned their policy to the contrary effect, for their conformity with idolaters, going on in a course which had a tendency at least that way. In other words, what he's saying is their compromises with idolatry had brought the judgment of God and hadn't given them that peace which they had sought. The first who publicly entered into covenant was the preacher in that town. And then he goes on, next, the whole people of the country present did solemnly acknowledge the oath, and by lifting up hands to God entered into the solemn league and covenant, with which were mixed prayers and singing of psalms after the ordinary exercise of preaching was over. There were few of the townsmen who entered into the covenant the first day, but they gave the ministers knowledge that their purpose was on Monday to enter into it, the ministers first commending them for their deliberate way of doing such a thing, observed the Monday and received them into covenant, both the mayor and others of the town, they desiring to do it by themselves, but so that their entering into the covenant they did abjure their former corruptions and renounce them. The point here is that far from just signing it without thought, the bulk of the leading people of the town said, we do want to do it, but we'll do it tomorrow, because we want time to give it further thought so that they could do it thoughtfully and conscientiously. So did the ministers and people of Ruth, who were all of them convened in two places, Billy and Dunluce. In the one was Mr. Adair, and in the other was Mr. Weir, where the former ministers followed the same way with others before them, and the people also. Mr. Adair and Mr. Weir took occasion from the ministers' repentance to show the people in public how dangerous it was to credit ministers without ground from Scripture. Well, they went on to Derry, as it was then called, and in Derry they had much conflict with certain individuals, but nonetheless large numbers ultimately signed the Solemn League and Covenant. They then went on to Raphoe in Donegal and to Letterkenny, where multitudes entered into the Solemn League and Covenant. At Ray, a place called Ray on the Lord's Day in Donegal, such a crowd gathered that one of the ministers preached in the meeting house, which was packed out, and the other minister preached to the people outside in the field. Then they went to Enniskillen and then back to Derry. And we read, when they returned to Derry, Adair says, the ministers, to close the work at Derry, did celebrate the Lord's Supper publicly in the great church, where the altar was removed to give place to the Lord's table, and God appeared most sensibly and comfortably in the administration by the power of his Spirit on ministers and people. All things were done with as much order as was possible in such a case. No scandalous or unknown person was admitted, and the gravest gentlemen in the towns and regiments attended the tables. After this work, the ministers, accompanied by special friends, came to the waterside, to Captain Lawson's house, where, kneeling down, they commended the people to God. They then went to Ballycastle and to Carrickfergus. This is Weir and Adair. Hamilton had changed and had stayed in the east side of the country, and the three ministers were now together. The Lord's Supper was observed at Newton Arch, Holywood, and Ballywalter. These ministers then returned to Scotland, and Patrick Adair, not to be the later writer, says that each of them, on returning to Scotland, met with sore trials. He says, lest they should be exalted above measure upon this great work wherein God had assisted them so signally. William Adair was very ill with fever at Newton Arch. Then when he got to Stranraer, he was ill again. Hamilton and Weir were kidnapped by the Highlanders. They were seeking to use them as hostages because one of their leading figures was a prisoner. They were seeking to get him released by capturing Hamilton and Weir. They suffered greatly during their captivity among the Highlanders, and Weir died, whereas Hamilton was rescued, lived long, and fulfilled a useful ministry at Dumfries and Edinburgh. So then, the Solemn League and Covenant was signed by large numbers in the northern part of Ireland. It was signed by some in Dublin, and ultimately, of course, it was signed by the monarch, the King of England, Scotland and Ireland, which is important. The restoration of Charles II to the throne in 1660 brought on the worst period of persecution for the Scottish Covenanters, and during that period we have the killing times in Scotland, where 1700 were banished to America, 750 were banished to the Northern Isles of Scotland, 3,600 were imprisoned, outlawed, or sentenced to death if they were caught. 650 were killed in skirmishes, 7,000 left Scotland, 362 were executed after trial, 498 were killed without trial. And of course we know the names of the leading ministers of that time, Cameron, Cargill, Renwick, and so on. And the ministers preached from the scaffolds, and the last of the covenanting ministers executed in Scotland was James Renwick, who sang Psalm 103 and read Revelation 19 as he stood on the scaffold to be hanged. But in Ireland, the persecution was not so severe, comparatively speaking. But most Presbyterians refused to conform to episcopacy. 61 of the 68 Presbyterian ministers were deposed for non-conformity to prelacy or episcopacy, government by diocesan bishops. It's worth noting that Adair in his history says that in 1654, adherence to the Solemn League and Covenant was a requirement of ordination to the Presbyterian ministry in Ireland. Now, how long it remained so, I've not been able to discover. But at that time, to be a Presbyterian minister, you had to adhere to the Solemn League and Covenant. I mention that for this reason. Presbyterianism in Ireland, historically, was covenanting. There is nothing that the Reformed Presbyterian Church held to that is not part of the original Presbyterian position. The Reformed Presbyterian Church was not the result, didn't come into existence as a result of introducing a novelty. The Reformed Presbyterian Church exists because it refused to abandon what others did abandon. So Presbyterianism in Ireland was originally covenanter in its entirety. But then later the toleration was given, but the Solemn League and Covenant was quietly forgotten. The Presbyterians began to compromise and realized that the Solemn League and Covenant was a sore provocation to the authorities. And so in the historical testimony of the Reformed Presbyterian Church we read, in Ireland, as in Scotland, persecution led to compromise and apostasy in the case of many. After a feeble resistance, most of the Presbyterian ministers, while still refusing conformity to prelacy, came at length to comply with several degrading requirements of the state. Like the indulged in Scotland, they departed from the spirit of the covenant and compromised their allegiance to Christ. They made high profession of loyalty and attachment to the throne. They accepted, thankfully, the royal toleration. From the hands of the perjured monarch, Charles II, they received for the year 1672 as regium donum £600. This most objectionable gift they received and defended on the plausible pretext that it was designed as compensation for loss of tithes in the parish churches. In reality, it was designed as a royal gift to reward and still further to ensure their acquiescence in measures unjust, tyrannical, and persecuting. Amidst this general alarm and defection, many of the people and a few of the ministers held fast their integrity, choosing reproach and suffering rather than abandon the testimony of Christ. Of the ministers, Michael Bruce of Killinchy, John Cruikshanks of Raphoe, and Andrew McCormack of Macharali deserve honourable mention. That's Macharali, just a few miles from us here. And Adairsay, he quotes Adair, they called the people to solemn and great meetings, sometimes in the night and sometimes in the day, in solitary places, where the people in great abundance and with great alacrity and applause flocked to them. There they spoke much against the bishops and the times. Their preaching did exceedingly please most people. Their boldness in openly daring the magistrate and in calling together great assemblies, contrary to his order, deeply impressed the common people, who not only countenanced them, but also contributed liberally to their support. Thus they continued for a considerable time, going from one place and from one parish to another, under disguise and often in the night time. They raised a public protest against prelacy and tyranny, preached the gospel with great power, and fostered meetings for prayer and fellowship, till they were compelled by persecution to make their escape for a time to Scotland. Bruce lived to see the revolution, dying in Scotland in 1693. Cruikshanks and McCormack won the martyr's crown on the field of battle, falling at Rullion Green in the cause of the Covenant. Thus deprived of their ministers, the Covenant-keeping people continued to assemble in fellowship meetings. In these they found that edification and comfort which they could not obtain at services conducted by men unfaithful to their covenant vows. Nor were they forgotten by their covenant king. From time to time they were refreshed by visits from faithful servants of Christ in Scotland. Among these was Alexander Peden, a man distinguished for faith, prayer, zeal, and fervent attachment to the covenanted testimony. His repeated visits to this country between 1670 and 1681 and his faithful labours, particularly in the district of Kells, served to encourage and strengthen the witness for truth in their day of sorest trial. So there was now a clear division between those who went along with the view that the Solemn League and Covenant was to be ignored and forgotten and denounced as treasonable, and those who held it to be their duty to abide by the Solemn League and Covenant. And so this division continued from now on, there were the Presbyterians who abandoned the Solemn League and Covenant, and there were the Presbyterians who held fast to it. And the latter were holding separate meetings for worship and fellowship and maintaining contact with the covenanting societies in Scotland. I'll just read briefly from Professor Lockridge at this point. The position of the Covenanters in the north of Ireland immediately following 1690, after the Revolution settlement, was a difficult one. They had no meeting houses for worship and no ministers. They were scattered throughout the province in comparatively small groups, especially in the counties of Antrim, Derry, East Donegal, and North Down, where the Scottish influence was strongest. Their prospects were dim and might well have been hopeless had not David Houston thrown in his lot with them in 1692. David Houston was born near Paisley in Scotland in 1633. He entered Glasgow University in 1648 and took his master's degree in 1654. Nothing is known of his training for the work of the ministry, but when he came to Ulster shortly after 1660, he came as a licentiate and undertook the supply of some congregations under the care of the Root Presbytery, which had been constituted in North Antrim in 1657. The relationship between David Houston and the Root Presbytery was never very cordial or satisfactory, though he was a member of the Presbytery. He had a strong attachment to the Scottish covenants and made no secret of the fact in his preaching. The Presbytery remonstrated with him and appealed to him to avoid, quote, an irregular carriage in preaching in way of opposition. He accepted the reproof and preached in mid-Antrim under the supervision of the Antrim meeting. When that meeting admonished him for, quote, scandal and disorderly conduct, and advised him to, quote, withdraw a while out of the country, he agreed to do so. He soon returned, however, this time to Ballymoney, where his preaching of covenanting principles is reported to have caused a rent in the parish. On the 27th of February, 1672, the Root Presbytery formally suspended him. This suspension was withdrawn in 1673 with the possible intention of encouraging him to return to Scotland. Houston continued his itinerant ministry, sometimes in Scotland and sometimes in Ulster. His outspoken criticism of his brethren, who were willing to accept the Regium Donum, and his obvious sympathies with the stricter Presbyterians who followed Cameron and Renwick, meant that he was a constant embarrassment to the Ulster Presbyterians, who sometimes referred to him as an inconvenient brother. He was ultimately deposed by the Root Presbytery, but the deposition concerned him very little, for he had some time before that date renounced his attachment to Irish Presbyterianism on his formal recognition by the Scottish covenanting societies. We find that he was held in high esteem by James Renwick, when Renwick was still living, and he says in a letter to Sir Robert Hamilton, I shall give you an account of our carrying towards the said Mr. David. When I was in England last summer, the general meeting of our societies, being informed that Mr. David Houston refused concurrence with and subjection to the ministers in Ireland because of their defections, and that he preaches faithfully against the sins of the times, did send to him Colin Allison and William Nairn to know the verity thereof. These, after a full and free communing with the said Mr. David and all the heads of our present testimony, received great satisfaction. He also signified unto them his resolution of coming unto us. The complaints that were made against him by his opponents in Ireland were investigated. The Scots Church sent someone over to find out if they were true, and then Renwick remarks, "For my own part, I thought he seemed to have a right state of the cause and a right impression of the case of the church, and to be tender-hearted and zealous in the frame of his spirit, particularly for the royalties of Christ and against the idol of the Lord's jealousy, the ecclesiastic supremacy and civil tyranny. Then he also says, as for Mr. David Houston, he carries very straight. I think him both learned and zealous. He seems to have much of the spirit of our early professors, for he opposes much the passing from any part of our testimony, and sticks close to every form and order whereunto we have attained. Early in 1689, Houston lived near Newton Arts, and he entered into a bond of compliance with Lord Mount Alexander of the Ards, that he would use his influence in the peaceful settlement of the country. The last 4 years of his life were spent at Armoy in County Antrim, and a reference to his work in Armoy is found in the complaint of a northern bishop to the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland in 1694, where he says of him, "He is a clergyman that preached up the Solemn League and Covenant, accusing the people of Scotland for not sticking to their league and having a congregation of 500 resolute fellows that adhere to him." At his death in 1696, he had firmly established the cause of Reformed Presbyterianism in Ulster. His ministry had united the covenanting societies in Ulster in a common fellowship and had isolated them from their fellow Presbyterians. The die had been cast, and though they would find it difficult, if not impossible, to get a minister of like mind, there was now no possibility of their abandoning the covenanting position, and entering the Irish Presbyterian Church. So, when it came to the Revolution Settlement in 1690, under King William, the Covenanters in Scotland and Ireland, whilst they accepted gratefully from God the relief of persecution, they rejected the Revolution Settlement because the covenants were ignored. There was no acknowledgement of the scripturalness of Presbyterianism. Erastian episcopacy, that is state-controlled government by diocesan bishops, was established in England. Elements of state interference in the government of the church were already present in the Revolution Settlement in Scotland. Compromisers, former curates and persecutors were admitted into the ministry and offices of the church. So in Scotland, there were now two branches of Presbyterianism: the Church of Scotland under the Revolution Settlement, and what became the Reformed Presbyterian Church that stood by the National Covenant of Scotland and the Solemn League and Covenant. Whereas the Revolution Settlement Church of Scotland hastily put the Westminster Confession in place as its doctrinal basis, the covenanting body held to the whole Westminster position, the Confession of Faith, the larger and shorter catechisms, the Directory of Worship, and the Directory of Presbyterian Government. That division in Scotland was mirrored in Ireland. And so in Ireland, you had the Presbyterian Church of Ireland and the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Ireland, the latter of which held to the whole position embodied and flowing from the Solemn League and Covenant. Now, in those days, the difference between the Presbyterians and the Reformed Presbyterians was the Solemn League and Covenant. Both bodies practiced exclusive psalmody, for example. All Presbyterianism in Ireland was originally psalm singing without instrumental accompaniment. They had the same form of worship. The dividing line was over the Solemn League and Covenant. And so for those many years, David Houston was the only Reformed Presbyterian or Covenanter minister in Ireland. After Houston's death, there were no Covenanter ministers in Scotland. They met in societies. The elders taught and exhorted the people. They had constant contact with the Scottish Church, and the Irish Covenanters were represented in 1712 at Arkansas in Scotland when John Macmillan led in the renewing of the covenants. As time went on, the Lord did raise up ministers. William Martin of Ballyspallan near Limavady studied under John Macmillan in Scotland, and then under the John Macmillan's son, also John Macmillan, and returned to Ireland and was ordained by the Scottish Presbytery, who came over here at the Vow near Ballymoney. And in 1763, the first Reformed Presbytery of Ireland was formed. One outstanding minister of that time was William Staveley of Knockbracken, who lived from 1743 to 1825. In 1811, the first synod of the Reformed Presbyterian Church met at Cullibackie, and the denomination was divided into four presbyteries: northern, western, eastern, and southern. That still, those names still exist today. And the church had grown through the preaching of the word, through the consistency of the ministries of the preachers, Presbyterians, and those from the seceded churches. There was a steady flow of people into the Reformed Presbyterian Church at that time. And the Reformed Presbyterian Church grew whilst maintaining a strict discipline. It grew. It grew when it was consistent. Well then, just briefly, one or two points of conclusion. We can maybe some other time look at the rest of the history up to the present time. But let's just review. The Reformed Presbyterian Church was the continuation of the Presbyterianism originally established in Ireland. Nothing of the Reformed Presbyterian Church's principles were an innovation. They were part of the original Presbyterian position. The body called the Presbyterian Church of Ireland is a breakaway. That may sound absurd because of its size today compared with the Reformed Presbyterian Church, but the Presbyterian Church of Ireland departed from the historic Presbyterianism of the early ministers in Ireland. The first point of departure was they abandoned the Solemn League and Covenant, and for a long time that was the main difference. They then later abandoned the Reformed pattern of worship. They abandoned exclusive unaccompanied psalmody. They then abandoned Reformed doctrine and allowed liberalism to be preached and countenanced. And then, of course, now we have the ordination of women and so forth. But the first point of departure was when they rejected the Solemn League and Covenant. Well, what about the Reformed Presbyterian Church today? We'll not say too much, but it is much weakened. And there is a lack of clarity as to exactly what the Reformed Presbyterian Church is now saying about the descending obligation of the Solemn League and Covenant. But happily this is being looked at so that we can be clear as to what we are saying about that descending obligation. Nevertheless, with all our present sins and faults, we have a goodly heritage, and we have a heritage that is to be prized because it is biblical and therefore worthy to be contended for. So let us pray for our church, for the Lord to raise us up again and to make the church fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as the sun.